We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. This hour, we'll be doing the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. It's something we do every other month on the show. And our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And when he is here, we open things up to general health questions. He sees people of all ages in his practice. So if you have a question about yourself, someone in your family, could be adult, could be child, any and all of that, I know that he will do his best to help you out. And we do these shows because, you know, maybe it's one place that you can start. You can ask some basic questions, get some basic answers, and then maybe you need to go and see someone who can see you because, of course, we can't. There's a limit to what we can do because the doctor can't see you. But I always say that, but I don't want to discourage people from calling either. Just to make sure you understand there are some limits on what it is we can do. But certainly we can take questions on a wide range of things. And if you would like to talk with the doctor, you may do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at any point, you can call us. Well, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure, David. Good to be back.
At the risk of nagging, we'll start out here and we'll talk about flu shots.
It's still the time.
It's still the time. And in our community, we have a good supply of I think of all of the vaccine now, and I believe the sort of the general recommendation is at this point, you're saying that probably everybody, just about everybody, should have both H1N1 and
the seasonal
flu
shots. The most recent recommendation came from the Illinois Department of Health, and they, I believe, starting tomorrow, are advocating that all of the public health departments distribute the H1N1 to all interested parties. They had been making a specific point of trying to get young people and pregnant women immunized, and at this point, they're basically opening it up to all comers. And pretty much the seasonal flu should be available for everyone as well. And okay. And both are still recommended to be obtained if folks haven't got it yet.
And there's nothing to prevent someone from having both at the same time?
That's correct.
Okay. And some people may have picked up on the I think public health officials are saying, we've seen, at least for the moment, we have seen a peak on H1N1.
Correct.
Now, but what we don't, you know, you almost hesitate to say that because you don't want people to hear that and say, oh, well, if I haven't got H1N1 shot, it's all done with. I don't have to worry about that now. It could come back.
Correct. And unlike the seasonal flu, which basically if you make it to spring and haven't gotten the seasonal flu, you're probably not going to get it. The H1N1 does not appear to be seasonal. It appears to be possible to get year-round. So there's really no necessarily peak time of year for that particular virus. So, yes, we have had a large outbreak of H1N1. Those numbers seem to be declining somewhat, but there are many people who basically are suspecting that we're going to get a second peak probably after the first of the year.
Okay. And when is the average peak for seasonal flu?
It basically can be picked up anywhere from late fall to early spring, but typically peaks in the winter months.
And after you get the shot, how long does it take before your body begins to
do build up the immunity?
For the traditional seasonal flu shot, it's actually been a couple of weeks. The recent studies with the H1N1 suggested that there may be immunity in as little as 10 days afterwards. So for both, certainly within 3 to 4 weeks, you should be considered protected.
So then that argues for if you haven't yet gotten the shot, you know, don't wait. As soon as you can,
right,
do it.
Yes.
All right. Well, we have a couple of callers here, and let's talk with them. Starting in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a question. It's not flu related.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's fine.
I have a question about my four-year-old son. And let me just say, we have a wonderful pediatrician. I haven't had a chance to ask him about this yet. We're going to do it at his four-year well-child visit. But I'm going to kind of take advantage of the fact that I can ask you this now, especially because it's not in front of my son. So he's four, and he's completely toilet-trained, except that he will not make a bowel movement in the toilet. Like, he'll ask for a diaper, and then he'll go into the bathroom and do his thing and then ask us to change him. And he just turned four, and we had said to him, you know, when you turn four, you can make poopy in the potty. And on the night before his fourth birthday, he said, I don't want to be four. I don't want it to be my birthday. And I finally realized it was because he assumed, like, that day he was going to have to start doing this thing that he hasn't been able to do or hasn't wanted to do, and he was just very anxious about it. And, you know, I finally said to him, don't worry, you don't have to do that. It'll happen whenever you want to. And, you know, we haven't pressured him about it, but we have talked about it. And I just wanted to ask your opinion, like, A, is this okay that he's four and not, for whatever reason, wanting to do this? I mean, I have two older boys who this just wasn't an issue for them. You know, they just kind of did it and it was fine. And
do you have any younger children?
No, he's our youngest. And
does he have any contact with younger children on a regular basis?
Yeah, he goes to daycare, and the thing is, he has a bowel movement at exactly the same time every single day, and it's always at home at night, like right before he goes to sleep. He says, oh, I need a diaper, and that's it. Like, he goes into the bathroom, he comes out 30 seconds later, and he's done. So he's not, as far as I know, he's not in pain. He's not, you know, holding it all day. He's not rushing home saying he needs a diaper.
Mm-hmm.
And at his daycare, you know, I've just kind of explained the situation to them, and they said, you know, if he ever comes to us and says, I need a diaper, that's fine, don't worry. But he does see other kids, you know, like going in the bathroom.
Okay.
But he just doesn't want to, and I don't know why.
Yeah, this, obviously, to the best of my ability over the radio, is probably not a medical or a physical issue, but this is a psychological issue. And there's the reason I was asking about the younger children is that we fairly commonly we will see older children on a temporary basis when a newborn gets a lot of attention. We will see the older children regress in terms of their behavior,
okay,
and sometimes
okay.
that includes toileting behavior
okay.
as well. But there is some secondary gain to the attention that he's getting from this issue. But where the origin of that is, I'm not sure, but this is not necessarily a physical medical issue, but more of a psychological issue. And
okay.
there may be something either with, you know, younger relatives or younger kids at the daycare, but there's something that he's picking up on that basically is a disincentive to you know, toilet in the manner you'd expect for his age.
Huh. Okay. You know, and he also, when we had this conversation the night before his fourth birthday, which was just a week or so ago, he said, I'm still tiny. You know, like, we had said, oh, when you're a big boy, you know, you make a poop in the potty, and
mm-hmm.
he just kept saying, but I'm still tiny, you know, and I finally said to him, you know what, you can turn four, and you can still be tiny. And he said, thank you. Hmm. And I, you know, I just feel like I don't know what, I don't know what the deal is with that. I mean, he's a very independent kid. He's very into, I want to do this myself. But he's also very attached to us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he wants a lot of, at night, he wants a lot of snuggling, cuddling. He's very routine. We do, you know, read our stories and sing our songs before we go to sleep. He's not like a clingy kid,
mm-hmm.
but he's a young four-year-old.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, it doesn't seem like he's in pain or anything's hurting him when he does have a bowel movement. He's not uncomfortable, you know, but there's just a thing about this means I'm going to be big.
Right.
And I don't know what that means.
And whether he has observed as, you know, again, other children or older siblings, as they've gotten older, have gotten less attention, and he's afraid mm-hmm. that he'll lose that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are all suppositions, but, mm-hmm. you know, talking that over with his physician that, you know, you both have known for some time, I think is a reasonable
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
This may also be an issue to be addressed, you know, psychologically with a counselor.
Okay. So it's kind of at that point.
Well, it depends because it's not causing any physical harm,
mm-hmm.
And to date, it hasn't interfered apparently with his socialization.
No, not at all.
So you know, there's certainly nothing here that's an emergency,
mm-hmm.
but obviously, you're expecting sometime in the relatively near future that things
yeah.
are going to progress and be a little bit more age appropriate.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't want to talk about it. At, you know, just at the well baby or well child visit, because he'd be there,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, and I didn't want to do something that would cause him more anxiety about it if he already has some, which he kind of, I guess it seems like he does.
Right.
You know? So I wasn't exactly sure how to handle that either.
Well, in many instances, it's perfectly appropriate to call your physician's office in advance and simply
okay.
leave a note, you know, with the office staff, the physician's nurse, and say, you know, I have this particular concern.
Mm-hmm,
can we address this as part of his visit, maybe with him, you know, not in the room? So that
okay.
they have some awareness of what your concern is before they
okay.
before you get there.
Okay. Okay. That gives me some stuff to think about. Thank you.
You're
okay,
welcome.
Thanks. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month, he's here. It's always on Monday, and we call the show Talk to the Family Doctor. That's kind of the idea. Whatever kind of question, general kind of health question you might have, you can call and talk to the doctor. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And let's talk with someone in Savoy. Line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question, thanks for taking my
sure.
call. My question is about vitamins. I went to the Walgreens the other day, and I'm a 58-year-old guy, and they've got probably 100 different kinds of vitamins to take. They got some just for men, some for, they call silver for older people, some that are generic that are very cheap. As a recommendation for a vitamin, a daily vitamin, is the generic cheap ones just as good as the higher priced ones, or in your opinion, or what would you suggest?
Current standard recommendations are that because the vast majority of folks aren't eating a full, healthy, well-balanced diet, that a good general multivitamin once a day is probably not an unreasonable thing. Now, if you're especially conscientious about your diet and you're not really missing anything, it's really probably unnecessary. But if you want to cover all the bases, a good generic multivitamin would probably be fine. I'm not aware of any specific studies that indicate that, you know, one preparation is necessarily better than the other. Many individuals will say, you know, I don't like the taste of one, or, you know, one of them upsets my stomach, you know. So you may simply try a couple different brands to find something that you know, physically tolerate. But no, I'm not aware of any special advantage to a brand name product versus a generic one.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, what about the those that are the ones for the men and ones for women. And then also they have ones for people who are, I don't know, where your dividing line is. Above a certain age, right, they have one, and then below a certain age, they have one.
Well, oftentimes the women's vitamins contain some extra iron. Women routinely in the premenopausal years are having menstrual blood loss, and iron deficiency is not necessarily uncommon in women. So that's probably the major difference in, you know, the gender-specific vitamins. After, as you say, a certain age, I don't know if the silver's name for the color of the hair of the people buying the vitamin or...
or how much it costs.
Or how much it costs, yes. There's really nothing dramatically different there. The key to adequate vitamins is still a diverse diet, but a good general multivitamin certainly isn't going to hurt anything.
Okay. Let's talk next with someone in Crete. Line 3. Hello.
Yes, I was wondering. My brother is 73 years old and is beginning to lose weight from 155, 154 to 146, 147 in the last month or two or three. I just wonder what the situation could be and what are the possibilities for that cause.
Big question. The list would be actually quite long. The really key question here is he trying to lose weight or is this unintentional weight loss?
Unintentional.
Yeah. Unintentional weight loss is rarely a sign of good health. So there is definitely a medical concern here. The list of reasons why that could be is extremely long, but definitely something that I would recommend that he see and talk to his physician about. On the basis of the questions that his physician will ask him, a more funneled down list of diagnostic possibilities will come out of that, and there probably will be some specific testing recommended to figure that out. But unintentional weight loss is virtually never a good sign. So he definitely needs that looked into.
But don't they usually lose weight, though, as they get older?
Not necessarily. People should not be routinely losing any significant amount of weight just as a result of getting older. No.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Let's go back here to Urbana. I think we have somebody here who was listening to the conversation with the first caller and maybe had something to add or suggest. Go ahead, line 1.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to follow up on this mother of the reluctant toilet trainer.
Mm-hmm.
I had a similar situation with my son. He didn't finally succeed in defecating on the toilet till about a month before kindergarten, and it was in many ways the same thing, I think, just a reluctance to kind of take a big new step. I wouldn't say he had attachment issues. I mean, he is a very attached child, but he also told me, because he was very verbal, that he was afraid of the smell. And what I ended up having to do was a little bit of a tough love thing and just lie and say, oh, you know what, we're out of pull-ups. If you want to go, you're going to have to sit on the toilet. And he threw a major fit and finally did the deed a little bit reluctantly. But it was a lot. I mean, he was actually 5 before it finally happened. So it was a long haul. He didn't have any other developmental issues. Urinating was fine, but for some reason there was just something about that. So he was also slow to wean, you know, so it could just be like the mother herself said, he's a young 4, and my child was certainly young for his age at most of those ages. So I just wanted to throw that out there as a possible solution.
Oh, okay.
Appreciate it.
Very good.
No problem. Bye.
I think this is one of those situations where each set of parents knowing their child as well as anybody will have to decide, you know, is this an issue I put my foot down on and you know, we make it an issue, or is this something that I can sort of work with over a longer period of time, be patient and you know, eventually achieve a goal that we can all be happy about. And that's something that I think she'll need to discuss with her son's physician and you know, with dad, and they'll need to kind of figure out, is this particular individual just going to be on the slower track, but is making progress and will eventually get there, or is this an issue that has perhaps deeper psychological import, or are we just being played and we need to put our foot down and say, you know, enough's enough.
Yeah, okay. And I guess it's also no great insight, but it certainly is true that while child development people and pediatricians and, you know, you can go out and buy books about, let's say, what sort of path development's supposed to happen at. And mm-hmm. and it says at this point they should do this, and at this point they should do this, and at this point they should. Well, it's true that every child is on his or her own schedule. So, you know, within, you got to say, well, there's going to be some play in that about, right, you know, how they're going to develop.
And any of those general reference books are going to be just that, general, on the average, usually kind of things. Mm-hmm. And each you know, set of parents needs to recognize that their child is, in fact, unique. That's what makes them so special. With that knowledge and mind, then decide what's the most appropriate course. But getting some additional feedback from, you know, somebody who's known the child a long time, like his physician, and putting into the context of how has he done overall so far, as well, I think is the important thing.
Okay. We're about midway through here. Dr. Jeff Swearingen is the guest. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month on a Monday, he's here for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And if you have a question, you're certainly welcome to call us.
Well, one of the things that the first caller, you know, was asking about, and I suggested that she leave a message for her son's physician mm-hmm. in advance of the appointment. Mm-hmm. We frequently get that kind of input in our office, and I think it's one of the sort of advantages of family medicine is that in many instances a husband will come in, and I am sort of forearmed with knowledge from his spouse, so that I can ask the appropriate question and delve a little yeah. deeper, and sometimes I will get, you know, adult children who will leave me a message about their older parents because there are some issues or concerns that may be subtle enough that it wouldn't come out in a regular office visit. But in many instances, if I receive that extra information, then I know in advance that, you know, there's potentially an issue that I need to address. And I can bring it up and leave the other family members out of it. It's sort of the good cop, bad cop sort of thing. But, you know, they can give me the information. I can pursue some of those issues without getting them in trouble.
Yeah. Well, that, I suppose that comes down to this question that people, I'm sure when people come in, there are things that they have on their minds that maybe they're reluctant to talk about, and I don't know if there's some way,
it's the classic. We teach this to our medical students all the time. You know, somebody's on the schedule for a particular reason. You address that during the course of their visit, and as your hand reaches for the doorknob,
say,
they
go, by the way.
That's exactly what it's called. It's called the oh, by the way. And it is, in fact, usually the reason they're really there. But unfortunately, they have now left it to the last 30 seconds of their appointment. And, you know, sometimes it's a big issue. It needs to be addressed, and it makes it difficult. You know, I think it's really helpful if folks can be, you know, very, very honest with their physician right up front and say, you know, I'm worried about this, or I'm concerned about that, or, you know, what do I do about this? You know, even if they're scheduled for something else, to be honest, in most instances, there's nothing I haven't heard already. You know, it's not going to come as a big surprise or as a big shock. And unless I know about it, you know, it's hard to deal with it. So if they can't sort of bring themselves to tell it while they're there, I often encourage folks to, in advance of their appointment, just write a note, send it to me. You know, for a number of our general exams, we ask people to fill out little questionnaires. Gives them the opportunity to, you know, answer a particular question, yes or no, and if it looks significant, I can follow up on it. But they don't necessarily have to bring it up, you know, as long as I read the list. Mm-hmm. So, the physician can really only deal with the information that they have at hand, and part of the process is making sure that all of the relevant information gets out there.
Is it that people, you think, are embarrassed about it, or just
some, depending on the issue? Sometimes it's embarrassment. In other instances, you know, it's really fear.
They're afraid of what you might.
Yeah, that sounds like cancer, and they don't want to hear that. You know, that's their fear, but they don't want to express it because then that sort of makes it a real possibility. So, you know, there's a variety of, I think, emotions at work during that process. But, you know, facing it and dealing with it, if somebody says, you know, I'm afraid this might represent cancer, that allows me to say, okay, then let's delve through your history and your exam and any type of testing and make that the first thing on our list to exclude, okay? And we can get that off the table, and then we'll deal with the things that really I think are much more likely to be the problem. A fairly common example is the person who comes in with headaches, you know, and if you get the whole history, what you find out is that, you know, Uncle George had a brain tumor. And the first thing on their list is, gee, do I have a brain tumor? Well, you know, 99.99% of headaches are not due to brain tumors. But if that's what their major concern is, then that's what the issue that we need to address first and get that off the table and then work through the much more likely explanations for the headache.
So later on, I'm going to talk to you about my headaches. let's talk with a caller here. Danville, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
I
am a woman, I'm 37 years old, and for a year and a half or almost, I've been taking Trisprintec as a birth control method, and I hadn't been on birth control for a long time, and I just started taking it, like I said, a year and a half ago, and I have been getting frequent yeast infection, and I told my physician, and she said, you know, you should eat more yogurt. And now it's becoming, I hate it. It's every other month or every 2 months.
And this is not a problem that you had prior to the birth control pill use?
Yeah.
The estrogen content of hormonal contraceptives can indeed create an environment that's a little bit more favorable for developing yeast infection. So there's really no doubt that that can potentially be a cause. Obviously, there are other causes as well, but it would certainly be reasonable to talk to your physician about using some other form of contraception if this is an ongoing issue for you.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Next, we'll talk with someone in Vermilion County on our line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Recently, I heard the term partial complex seizure as a possible problem. Could you, I don't know anything at all about it. Could you tell me a cause and consequence of that?
That's actually a fairly broad term. The classification of seizure disorders has undergone some change over the years. What we now refer to as generalized seizures is what used to be referred to as a grand mal seizure, where somebody would lose consciousness, fall to the ground, their arms and legs would twitch, their eyes might roll back in their head, they could, you know, bite their tongue, they might be incontinent.
As a consequence of epilepsy, though,
that is the most common cause for that type of seizure. But people who have other medical problems can also develop seizures as well. But the most common cause for that generalized seizure was, in fact, epilepsy. There are subsets of epilepsy, where people don't lose consciousness, don't necessarily have their entire motor system activated, and this is the result of only one portion of the brain becoming electrically disturbed instead of the entire brain. So these become partial seizures, and simple ones will involve a very small area, and there may be a particular type of activity associated with it, but it's not total loss of consciousness, and it's not complete activation of all the motor units, so that, you know, they may not be moving their arms and their legs. Things as subtle as staring off in space for a little while. People who have some partial seizures may simply repetitively smack their lips for a few minutes. But if you try to engage them in conversation, they're not really with you. And so seizure disorders represent an electrical disturbance within the brain, and it's simply a question of which particular areas of the brain are you involving, and does it start in one particular area and stay there, or does it in fact generalize and then eventually involve the entire brain? And so the treatment for these is dependent on what's causing them. The partial seizures need evaluation to make sure that it is not the result of, say, this is a situation where if somebody's brand new has the new onset of any kind of seizure activity, you are going to evaluate them for brain tumors. You're going to investigate into the possibility of bleeding into the brain that's caused problems. Certain other clinical situations where bad infections have caused seizures, high fevers can cause seizures. There's a whole host of reasons why somebody might have a seizure. If it's a brand new occurrence, it does need a very thorough neurological evaluation. If it's an old problem, you know, somebody says, yeah, I've had epilepsy all my life, and they're having the same kind of seizure that they always had, then that's probably not anything that needs a huge workup. They just need to make sure that their medications are adjusted appropriately to minimize that.
Well, thank you. That helps explain it.
No, well, thank you for the call. Well, again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. A little gunk issue here myself this morning. So we're into the flu and cold season. And one of the questions that that always comes up when we get at this point is people want to know, well, I know that there are lots of germs floating around. And are there any particular things, really reliable things, that I can do to try to lessen my chances of getting sick with a cold or flu? He's looking at me like he's shaking his head.
Of course there is.
Oh, okay.
It's what Mom told you.
Oh, yes.
Wash your hands.
Wash your hands.
Single most important thing that can be done to prevent the spread of any infectious disease is wash your hands. Obviously, staying away from people who are already ill. Unfortunately, in many instances, people infect themselves with their hands, even if they have, you know, made a diligent attempt to stay away from other individuals. If there's enough public traffic, there are going to be some germs on the doorknob and on the hand railing and places where if you then take your hand and place it to your mouth or nose, you'll essentially infect yourself. So we strongly encourage people to stay away from other sick people. If you yourself are sick, stay home so that you're not infecting others. Mm-hmm. But very, very frequent hand washing, keeping your hands away from your face. If you do have a cough or a sneeze, turning your head into the crook of your elbow is now the sort of recommended procedure. The kids refer that to that as the Dracula maneuver, where they bring their arm up across
like that
in front of their face as though they had a cape. But, you know, if that helps them remember, then, you know, that's good. Mm-hmm. Because then that prevents you from contaminating your own hands, and your hands then touch something else and you end up giving it to somebody else. And goes back to the other things that we talked about earlier. Get your vaccinations. If there are infectious diseases that can be prevented by immunization, then by all means, to take advantage of that.
Yeah.
And adults, we harp on the flu shots, certainly seasonally, but adults always think of their kids needing their school shots, but adults need to have their immunizations updated periodically as well. Diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus all need to be updated periodically. The flu shots, there are pneumonia vaccinations, and there are now vaccinations to help prevent shingles as well. So there are a variety of adult vaccinations, and that should be one of the things that folks discuss with their physicians when they're in for their regular visits.
And just for pneumonia, at what age?
Routinely 65 and above, but individuals who are at an age younger than that but have other significant medical issues, the bad heart patients, the bad diabetic patients, folks whom if you threw a bad case of pneumonia on top of wouldn't do well, those are all very reasonable folks to get immunized as well.
Okay. Urbana, let's talk with a caller, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Would you be able to explain what is pulmonary fibrosis and if it is treatable? I'll hang up and I'll listen.
Okay.
Sort of the quick and dirty, it's sort of a scarring process that occurs in the lung that ultimately interferes with the ability of the lung to exchange oxygen from the air into our bloodstream. So over a period of time, as the fibrosis and scarring occurs in the lung, it becomes much more difficult to stay well oxygenated, and people generally then start to feel, as such, short of breath. So this is a potential cause of progressive shortness of breath. It is really not terribly well understood as to why people get it, and there really isn't, to the best of my knowledge, any real specific treatment, something that, stops or reverses the process. In most instances, we're trying to protect people's remaining lung function by getting them to stop smoking, obviously avoid any environmental exposures that are harmful to the lung, and treating or preventing respiratory infections that can also compromise lung function.
Okay. Other questions, welcome. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The pesky thing about the cold is that there are a lot of different viruses that can cause colds.
Hundreds.
Once you get the one,
right,
your body says, okay, we got to fight this. You gear up and you deal with that. And so a week, 10 days, pretty much it goes away. But then, a week, 2 weeks, a month later, you could get another one and you got to do the whole thing over again.
Right.
Is there anything that that reliably you can do to try and either keep your immune system really running in top form, or if you think you're getting a cold or you're just right at the beginning, is there anything that you can do to juice it up a little bit so that it will really get right on that?
All right. We'll go back to our preventive things.
Yes. I told you before.
Wash your hands, right. But no, people are, in fact, more subject to coming down with something if they are malnourished, have had poor sleep, are doing things to their body that interfere, tobacco and alcohol.
Okay.
And so, the basic things that we associate with good health, which is, a good diet, not abusing those substances, getting an adequate amount of sleep, doing something to, manage our stress, are all things that will minimize your chances of coming down with something. It's certainly not guaranteed to prevent every possible illness, because the amount of exposure that we get is really tremendous. I mean, just wandering around, it's part of life.
Everywhere.
You're exposed to all sorts of things. In terms of when you're getting a cold, you know, this is where, you know, some folks said, gee, you know, vitamin C does it for me. Mm-hmm. I've seen, you know, studies that have gone both ways on that. I haven't reached any personal conclusion. You know, I don't think it's going to hurt anybody to take a little extra vitamin C. There is an over-the-counter product called Zycam.
The thing that's got zinc?
Which is a zinc supplement that has been helpful, again, in some limited studies in terms of trying to abort a cold. Unfortunately, just recently, the FDA came out with a statement that said a certain number of people who've used this particular product have suffered a permanent loss of sense of smell.
Really?
Yeah, because the Zycam is a product that you put in your nose. And so, yeah. It's
that's not a good trade-off.
Well, no.
I don't think I would take it.
It was a relatively rare thing, but they actually have a number of cases now that they think are linked to this. So, yeah, people have to decide, gee, is putting up with my cold worth maybe losing my sense of smell? Otherwise, I'm not aware of any special things that you're going to be able to do to ramp up your immune system.
All right. Champagne, next, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've got a teenage daughter who was diagnosed with cough variant asthma last spring. And after a couple of months on an inhaler, it got settled down. We noticed a few additional problems in the fall, and then about 10 days ago, it got really, really bad. Her cough just doesn't end. We've talked with her doctor, and she's changed her to a different inhaler, but how do we know what makes it worse, and how do we determine what to keep her away from, to keep from getting these symptoms?
Okay. Excellent question. Asthma is a relatively common problem. There are people who are simply born with a tendency toward asthma, and it's something that expresses itself as they get older, and it's not due to anything other than the genetic inheritance that they were given. In other instances, people who have, you know, what we call reactive airways, they're fairly sensitive. If they have environmental allergies, if they come down with a bad respiratory infection, if they're exposed to irritants, things that they inhale, smoke being the most common one, they can set off a response in the airways. Our bronchial tubes basically need to stay open for us to get air in and out. When they constrict and get smaller, one of the ways in which you can temporarily force that tube open is to cough. When you cough, you are blowing that tube open momentarily, okay? And this is why it's called cough variant asthma, because these folks frequently cough and don't necessarily wheeze like we normally expect folks with asthma to do. So in this particular setting, spring and fall are very common times for environmental allergies, and that's a very frequent trigger for asthma. It can also simply be related to infections, respiratory viruses most commonly, looking at inhaled exposures in the especially in the fall when the farmers are out in the fields, that kicks up a lot of stuff that that people often have trouble with. And so defining times and places where this occurs is helpful in trying to figure out if there is in fact an external trigger.
Okay.
And then in terms of the medications, you've probably been instructed that there are medications to decrease inflammation in the bronchial tubes. There are medications that long-term help to keep them open.
Right.
And there are short-term inhaled medications that will very quickly dilate up the bronchial tubes so that they're open in a hurry. And the correct combination of sort of long-term preventive medications and short-term medications that you can use acutely is the usual management for asthma.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, very good. About 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. It's our family doctor show. We do it every other month on a Monday And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I guess one other thing I thought you might maybe have a couple things to say about that's also of a seasonal nature, and that is
Christmas shopping?
no, but it is related to holidays. Depression.
I personally think that the acronym SAD, S-A-D,
seasonal affective disorder,
yeah. Is just a normal routine fact of life in the Midwest. It is cold. It is gray. It is just somewhat of a downer.
And it seems like this fall, it's been even more. Well, we've had even more cold, gray,
yeah,
wet, damp, wet, nasty.
Yes.
You know,
right.
So yes, clearly, it has something to do with lack of sun exposure.
It does. It really does.
And is there, you know, for people, and it actually certainly it is possible for people to have that, and it's very severe. It's,
yes.
It's something that they need medical attention. You know,
that's correct.
It can be very bad. For everybody else, it's kind of like, you know, it's more of a nuisance, but it's still.
But it's why they invented Florida.
So that's your prescription?
That's right.
Doctor, go someplace warm and sunny.
And take your doctor with you.
Okay. If we can't do that. Is there really much that constructive again that people can
yes,
really do?
Yes, actually there is. And in fact, they sell a light kit specifically for this. There are a couple different manufacturers. I can only remember one of them off the top of my head. I think it's called Northern Lights. But they basically have a special bulb that if you put, you know, say above your desk or, you know, someplace where you're going to be for, you know, a couple of hours, it actually basically mimics the beneficial effects that you'd have gotten from being outside in the sun. And it has been shown to be helpful. The standard antidepressant medications are often used seasonally by folks who have this problem, and they can be effective as well. But again, the basic things, you know, are you eating well? Are you getting enough sleep? What do you do about your stress? Because, you know, the holidays, you know, everybody has this picture of the, you know, perfect family holiday, and trying to meet that expectation can be pretty stressful, and it's pretty disappointing if it doesn't meet that expectation. So mm-hmm. So this is a fairly common time for people to have depressed mood. Resetting our expectations, limiting our activities so that we're not trying to do, you know, 20 different social activities, you know, every week. I personally think that getting enough regular exercise is extremely helpful. And so a lot of these things can be addressed with a little bit more attention to lifestyle, limiting our stressful exposures. But for people who are seriously affected, light substitution and antidepressant medication can be quite useful.
And it's something about the spectrum
yes.
at this particular light.
Yes.
So it's not like any
no.
not like any light bulb. There's a particular
right.
kind of light.
Right. That's exactly right.
It seems like one of the things that I think we've been hearing more and more about over the last couple of years particularly is concerns about people's vitamin D levels and whether it's enough. And I would expect that at this point in the year that maybe is going to become more of an issue because we don't get the sun exposure.
As people probably realize that our skin makes vitamin D after being exposed to sunlight. And as long as we get an adequate amount of sun exposure, most people aren't vitamin D deficient. But you're correct. In the you know, the northern climes in the winter, there aren't too many people out sunbathing. So they're not getting a whole lot of sun exposure. And it's quite possible to, you know, go to work in the dark and come home in the dark and never even see the sun. So in those particular instances, supplementing some additional vitamin D, that's probably not an unreasonable thing. The amount that's currently being recommended seems to be climbing upwards. There are a number of studies that are potentially linking either as an association, not yet a cause and effect relationship, between heart disease, cancers, certain types of infectious processes, and depressed levels of vitamin D. What we don't really know yet is, would simply replacing vitamin D, you know, fix that, or is this a result of some of those conditions? So there's a lot of future research that needs to be done, but certainly in the winter months, supplementing with a little extra vitamin D is not an unreasonable thing to do.
Okay. Well, do you think, for example, I think now the other day I was looking at the multiple vitamin that I take, and I think that it has what is the current, what is 100% mm-hmm. of what is the current recommendation for D, which is, I think, 400
international
I
units.
Use.
Right.
And as you say, though, you think that that's going
to move up to 800 to 1,000. And in particular, women, as they hit the menopausal years and the concerns about needing an adequate amount of vitamin D to metabolize calcium to prevent osteoporosis, those recommendations are going to go up.
Okay. Maybe one more thing just in the way of a cautionary note, particularly because now people are dealing with cold and flu symptoms and they may be taking medications that have all kinds of different things in them. Again, maybe it's sort of worth saying, watch your acetaminophen intake.
It is possible, if you're not careful, to take Tylenol,
yeah,
which is chemically acetaminophen. But a fair number of cold and flu medications also contain Tylenol or acetaminophen. So, yes, it is, in fact, possible to cumulatively take in more than you really should, and that can, in fact, be a significant problem for your liver.
I think it's something that seems to be getting, relatively recently, have gotten more attention. And do you think, is it possible that there's going to be some change in recommendations about dosage? Like, for example, I think that maybe there are some people are thinking that the standard extra strength mm-hmm. that you get over the counter maybe is too much.
It's not so much that it would be too much as a single dose, but, you know, unfortunately, many people will say, well, gee, you know, I took that 15 minutes ago and my headache didn't go away. Yeah. I'm going to take it again. You know, as long as you follow exactly the amount and the timing of repeating that dose, you shouldn't get yourself into trouble. But people, I think, many times just don't follow
They're
the directions.
Not paying attention. Okay. Well, with that, we'll leave it. Our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, is family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here every other month. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. My pleasure.